This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provide signature support for our program. Our number is 877-217-5757. Please send emails to talk@talklouisiana.org. We begin with a special guest indeed, David Fahrenthold, Pulitzer Prize winner for The Washington Post. He won his Pulitzer in 2017 for coverage of the former president's finances, mainly alleged charitable givings, which involved 2016 and the presidential election in which Donald Trump eked out a victory over Hillary Clinton. David Fahrenthold is back on the story as President Trump is now being investigated in his former home state of New York by the state attorney general. And good morning, David Fahrenthold.
Good morning.
And before we get started, I know you've been with the Post now for more than 20 years, despite being a young man. You've spent about half your life there, but you also, I think prior to the Post, were briefly, very briefly, with the Times-Picayune in New Orleans.
I'm so glad you mentioned that. That was such a fun time. I lived in uptown New Orleans for a summer. I got to see a lot of the state. I really have such fond feelings for the state now.
David is a native of Houston and a BA in history from Harvard 2000, wrote for the Harvard Crimson, and he has done a remarkable work in covering financial matters. Is not always a thing that journalists find easy. Journalists are better at words than numbers, but David's good at both, and there are a lot of words and numbers when we look at President Trump, correct?
That's right. That's one thing I like about covering his business and the dollars and cents is, unlike a lot of things about Trump, they don't change. You know, once you find money, it stays found, unlike a lot of his political positions.
Let's go back to a few years ago first. There have been so many stories about President Trump, both regarding his finances and otherwise, his personal life, you name it, his, of course, his the way he managed the White House. And some of those are ripe for investigation if a prosecutor wants to go that route. You came across some things from 2016, 2017, now 4 years removed, that were suspect. Tell us more about that.
Well, what I started looking at was something called the Donald J. Trump Foundation, which is a tax-exempt charity, a registered charity that Trump ran. And what we discovered was that he had used his charity basically as another pocket of his wallet. He'd used it to buy things for himself, to buy paintings for himself, paintings that hung on the wall of his golf clubs. He used his charity's money to settle legal settlements for his businesses, and he used it to help his campaign. He basically made it into an arm of his 2016 campaign. All of those things are against the law. And so as a result of our reporting, the Donald J. Trump Foundation was sued by the New York Attorney General, shut down, and Trump had to pay $2 million in damages for misusing money in a charity.
But that was a civil action. No criminal charges were brought against them, but they could have been. People have been tried for lesser matters.
That's correct. It was in that case, the New York Attorney General filed a civil lawsuit. There was no attempt to press criminal charges.
And for those, and there's so many stories about the former president that they're hard to keep up with. But for those unfamiliar, as you just stated, he actually used his charity to buy an oil painting of himself. Is that right?
Two oil paintings of himself. He went to there was a charity auction at Mar-a-Lago in which someone was auctioning off a picture of him, and he did that happen twice. He paid $10,000 one time and $20,000 another, and you know that's fine. It's certainly legal to buy a picture of yourself, but he used the charity's money to do it. And once you've used the charity's money to do that, you have to use that asset, that painting, for a charitable purpose. And he did not. He just hung it on the wall of his golf club.
Now, he has declined to release his tax returns, still does. Explanation through the years has been that he's under an audit. It's been a very long audit.
That's right. Well, the New York Times had a great story on this last year that he really might be under audit. That's not a reason to not release his taxes. You know, you can release your taxes if you're under audit just fine. But he claimed a huge tax refund in 2009, according to the Times, I think $90 million, something on that scale. And the IRS since then has been trying to figure out basically whether he fooled them, whether he fooled them into giving him a tax break he didn't deserve. So there really was an ongoing fight with the IRS, but it shouldn't have stopped him from releasing his taxes.
Well, quite often in scandal-plagued administrations, even in Watergate, the mantra is follow the money. Is the money leading somewhere on this?
Well, there's a couple different ways in which that is true now. One is that we are trying to figure out how Trump used the presidency to basically put government money into his own pockets, and he still is. As president, he directed at least $2.5 million of taxpayer money into his own pockets by him and his family visiting their property and then charging Secret Service agents to go along with them. Secret Service agents have to be near the president wherever he is. So he would go to Mar-a-Lago, they'd have to follow, and then he'd charge them for the space they used there. He got about $2.5 million while he was president doing things like that. And we just reported this morning that he's continued to do it as a former president. Since Trump left office, you know, when he moved to Mar-a-Lago full-time, he's charged the Secret Service $396.15 every night for the room they use while they protect him. So he's gotten $40,000 from the taxpayers just since leaving office. The other way we're looking at following the money is these two investigations of Trump in New York, where the Manhattan DA and the New York Attorney General are both trying to figure out whether he broke laws with his financial practices before he became president.
What about his hotel down the street from the White House?
That was the subject of a long court battle over the Constitution's Emoluments Clause. So the Constitution says presidents can't accept, quote-unquote, emoluments, which is sort of an old-fashioned word for gifts, from foreign governments. And so Trump was sued because he did business with foreign governments there at that hotel in Washington. He was sued by the D.C. Attorney General and the Maryland Attorney General. And they basically spent 4 years fighting over who had even the right to bring such a lawsuit, you know, who could come to court to challenge whether the president had violated that clause, and basically never figured it out. The case ended when Trump left office and became moot.
But those dignitaries often stayed at that hotel. And
they did.
And I know because of traveling to Washington, and I've never stayed there, but the price there is higher than any hotel in the city.
It's an extremely expensive hotel, and you're right. There were embassies like the Embassy of Kuwait, the Embassy of the Philippines that had big parties there. The Saudi government paid hundreds of thousands of dollars for people to come stay there as part of a lobbying campaign. There were foreign leaders who stayed there when they were in Washington. We don't know how much money they took in, but certainly you're right, the rooms are expensive, and there were a number of times that foreign governments rented them.
877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org for David Fahrenthold, one of the top reporters in America, Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting in 2017 for his work on Donald Trump's charity claims, casting doubt on the former president's assertions of generosity toward charities. The president has made claims through the years that he's been extremely generous, but your work has proved otherwise. How so?
Yes, Trump for years had sort of, I think, recognized that, you know, he played this kind of playboy figure in the public imagination. And he recognized that part of that should be like sort of extravagantly generous. And so often over the years, he would make these really extravagant promises to give to charity. You know, I'm going to give away the proceeds of The Apprentice. I'm going to give away the proceeds of Trump vodka. I'm going to give, you know, as a candidate, he said, I'm going to give $1 million of my own money to help veterans. And what we found was that often he didn't follow up at all. He didn't live up to those promises. We searched high and low for any evidence that he'd given money out of his own pocket and found precious little. In fact, the Trump Foundation that he did use, that was a charity that he controlled, and he often gave its money out. And people thought, well, this foundation has Donald Trump's name on it. Donald Trump's a rich guy. This must be Donald Trump's money. But in fact, it wasn't. The bulk of the money in the Trump Foundation, which Trump kind of gave away as, quote unquote, his gift, the bulk of that money came from Vince McMahon, the wrestling magnate. He gave Trump a few million bucks in like 2007, and Trump spent the next few years giving away Vince McMahon's money.
A listener notes that in October of 2016, it was David Fahrenthold, our guest, who broke the news of the Access Hollywood video. How did you find out?
That's one thing I can't tell you. But I can tell you we were not expecting to find it. You know, there had been a lot of rumors about tapes of Trump on the set of The Apprentice doing various things, which nobody ever found. But we didn't know about it. I didn't know Trump had ever been on Access Hollywood until a source came to us with this tape. And we knew immediately that it was something different. You know, we had heard Trump's voice a lot over that campaign. But you never really heard him talking in that way, using those sorts of terms. You know, and the tone of his voice saying sort of like, can you believe I can get away with this? That was the side of Trump we'd never seen before. We knew it was really important right away.
You saw the tape before the rest of us did.
Yeah, I showed it to my colleague sitting next to me to say, like, this is as important as I think it was, and she almost choked. And, you know, so we knew we got the tape at 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning, and we had it published by 4 that afternoon. It became at the time the most viewed story in the history of the Washington Post website.
How did he survive that?
It's a good question. I think it was a couple of things. One, it happened about a month before the election. It wasn't right before the election, so there was time for him to recover. Trump did apologize, which is an unusual thing for him. And I think that I think if the two major events of the last month of the campaign, that the Access Hollywood tape and the revelation from Jim Comey that Hillary Clinton's emails were being reexamined, if those had happened in the opposite order, I think Trump would have lost. But the damage to Trump was done in April. I mean, in a month earlier, Republicans began to realize after a while that they were okay with it, or they hated Hillary Clinton more than they cared about what Trump had done. And then Jim Comey's revelation a few days before the election sunk Hillary Clinton just enough.
All right, we do have to take a pause, but we will have David Fahrenthold with us for a few more minutes when we return after this 90-second pause, and we'll hear more about the investigation against Donald Trump in New York. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. We're pleased to have David Fahrenthold, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, still a young man, but more than 20 years of his life at the Washington Post, and he's in his early 40s. And he is responsible for many of the big stories about President Trump that the Post reported over the last several years. In fact, at one point, White House spokesperson Judd Deer said the White House was building a dossier on David. How did that go, David Fahrenthold?
Well, it didn't, as far as I know. That threat was made, I think, in August of last year in response to one of our stories about how Trump was basically using the White House to direct government money into his own pockets. They said they were going to compile a dossier on me. We never heard about it again. If that dossier exists, I've never seen it. And frankly, my life's pretty boring anyway, so I pity the person who'd have to try to dig up dirt.
Bill Huey writes, in 2016, the president, then presidential candidate, Trump came to Louisiana, promised to donate $1 million of his own money to aid victims of the 2016 flood in Louisiana. Bill says people gushed all over it, but I don't believe Trump ever gave the money. Does Mr. Fahrenthold happen to know anything about that?
I do know, actually. That was at a point after we had started covering Trump's tendency to not follow through on his promises. And so in that case, I think it was $100,000. He did actually give it. He gave it to a ministry run by a really big church in the Baton Rouge area. So, yes, in that case, he did actually live up to the promise.
Well,
but I should
say,
good. At that point, he knew people were watching.
Well, but it was $100,000, and that's significant, even for a man of the means of Donald Trump.
Certainly.
He has said he's worth $10 billion. Do you believe that?
This is one of those things that I didn't realize was as complicated as it was before I got into covering somebody like Trump. There's a huge range, you know, so much of his claimed wealth comes from him saying, well, you know, I believe my brand is worth $3 billion or something like that, you know, assigning value to a definite value to an intangible thing. He certainly owns a lot of valuable assets. He owns a 30% stake in two office buildings. He owns a number of golf clubs and some hotels. Trump's business has certainly suffered over the last couple of years, both because of his politics and because of COVID. But he certainly has a lot of assets. I don't know if it's $10 billion or $1 billion or less than that, but he's got a lot of valuable assets.
And certainly the richest person to ever be president of the United States.
I think that's true, yes.
Now, what about now? In New York, the state attorney general has opened an investigation, and this is criminal investigation, into the president's actions in his former home state, the state of his birth. Does this have legs?
You know, I think it does. So there's two big long-running investigations of Trump in New York, one by the Manhattan DA, which was always criminal, and then one by the New York Attorney General, which began as a civil investigation, basically one that was going to end in a lawsuit until recently. And then the New York Attorney General has said recently that she also has discovered some evidence that has led her to open a criminal investigation. Those investigations have gone on a long time. They've gathered huge amounts of data about Trump, and these are by far the most in-depth, far-reaching investigations of Trump's finances that anyone has ever done. So, you know, I don't know until they file something what they've got, but they certainly, at the end of these investigations, you won't be able to say, well, you know, if only somebody would look into Trump's finances, you know, who knows what they'd find. They've looked. And I think we're going to have a lot of mysteries solved. I don't know if it's going to mean criminal charges or a lawsuit or both, but they've certainly looked into Trump much more than anybody ever has.
Does it involve family members as well?
It does, actually. We know it involves at least Eric Trump, the president's middle son. One of the allegations against Trump that I think both the attorney general and the DA are investigating is that basically he got a huge tax break he didn't deserve on an estate he owns in suburban New York. Trump said, okay, I'm going to agree to conserve my land and not build extra houses on it. And so that's a huge loss of value to me because I could have built houses here. So I guess you get a $21 million tax break. The question is, like, he didn't have the permission to build those houses. Could he ever have done it? Did he claim more value than he really should? Eric Trump was really in the middle of that, from what we know from court filings. He's talking to appraisers, talking to lawyers, seemingly trying to pump up the assessment. So I think if there's any Trump child that is in sort of the middle of all this, it's Eric.
Well, this is a story that, of course, has layers, and when we're talking about dollars, it can become complicated, but I'm trying to do this in a layman's way, but the basic allegations are that he undervalued assets when it was in his best interest financially and overvalued them when it was in his best interest and may have shaded the truth and also skirted the law. Is that basically what we're talking about?
You're right. He undervalued them when it came to paying taxes on them and overvalued them when it came to trying to get people to see him as a good credit risk and give him loans. Now, there's some amount of wiggle room and puffery that's involved in real estate. And so what these authorities are going to have to prove is that what Trump did was more deliberate and more extreme than just what's regularly accepted in real estate.
Well, what is regularly accepted? Is it a given that people use what you call puffery?
I think it is a given to some degree, and you know, I think that's not a part of the law, but any jury or judge would probably realize that. The question is, is there documentation where some appraiser says, "Look, in my professional opinion, the value of this land is X," and Trump says, "Well, forget it, we're going to describe it as 3X," or where Trump says to a lender, "Look, here is the value. I have this piece of land that's worth this many million dollars because I have the right to build 30 homes on it," when really he doesn't have the right to build any homes on it. You know, are there like clearly false and material misrepresentations to either taxing authorities or lenders?
From a political standpoint, David, this could cut both ways. There are people who want a pound of flesh from the former president, and there are others who may dislike him intensely and just want to move on. And then there's the prospect of this becoming a circus. And what would happen, for example, if he went to trial and got acquitted? I would think he would be viewed as a martyr, and his popularity would probably reach new levels of intense support from people. But it's not a given that this is going to help or hurt one side or the other politically until it all plays out, is it?
That's right. I mean, one parallel to this you might think about is the Mueller investigation. Think how long that went on and how sure some people were that Trump was being railroaded and how sure other people were that Trump would be arrested and hauled out to, the White House in handcuffs. And it ended kind of with a whimper because of the way, Mueller's caution and Mueller's decision not to charge Trump. And it did, I think, boost Trump's popularity in the end that, Trump had been claiming all along this was a witch hunt. And look, now maybe it was. There's no charges here. I think if you're the Manhattan DA or the New York Attorney General, I would hope that if they choose to charge Trump or sue him, that it's not over something that they, that it's not over something small. That it's something where they feel like they have definitive proof. It's a slam dunk case. Because if they do go into this case with, a kind of an iffy set of evidence, it does create the impression that the law is being used for political gain. That's bad. And if you're Trump's enemies, you wouldn't want that to happen either. Because if Trump is acquitted, then it looks like he really is Teflon, and all this time people were out to get him when he hadn't done anything wrong. I do hope that they are, if they do take action against him, that it is a slam dunk case.
Well, if he were acquitted, he would be the new Teflon Don. Yeah. But David, when those tax returns of his were released, and we pretty much know they're valid, 15 years, I think, were there any whoppers in there that you looked at and said, "Can you believe this?"
Yeah, the New York Times last year published some amazing stories about Trump's tax returns, and there were several things that surprised me. I was surprised at the depth of the losses for so many of his businesses. We've been writing about how they weren't doing well, but many of them seemed like had lost money forever and never turned a profit. And I was amazed at his overall income tax. I think even a couple of years while he was president, was like $750. And he paid much, much less than I think most Americans do. I mean, there are people who work at McDonald's who pay more than $750 in taxes every year. So, yes, the depth of his losses and the tiny size of his tax payments, as much as I thought I knew him and how he worked, both those things surprised me.
Well, David Fahrenthold, Pulitzer Prize winner, it is an honor to talk with you. Keep up your good work, and we'll be following, reading you, and hopefully have you back right here sometime soon. Thank you, my friend.
I'd love to be back. Thank you.
Thank you. Keep going. And as we hit the break, producer Katie Ann McDonald is running the board today. You hear her beautiful voice when you call in. She is from Great Britain, and she's also a track star at Louisiana State University, a sophomore, not quite 21 years old. And last week, she finished second in the 800 meters with a time of 2:05.21, just steps behind the person who's considered the best in the country, Amber Tanner of Georgia. So she'll be heading to the regionals next week. And we wish her well, and certainly we look forward to her heroic return to Talk Louisiana. We'll be back with more of our program after this quick timeout. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Our guest for a little bit here is Kathy Baldridge. She is a nurse practitioner in Pineville, the director of Psychometric Analysis at Advanced Practice Education Associates. That's a nurse practitioner education company. And there has been a bill in the legislature that got through the House by a pretty substantial margin, 60-41, House Bill 495, that has divided medical professionals. Doctors say patient safety is at stake. Nurses say they already practice relatively independently and that giving them more leeway will find a worrisome gap in a state with a shortage of physicians. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning. So, thank you for having me.
Well, our pleasure. What's going on as far as where it is in the Senate right now?
So it passed the Senate Health and Welfare Committee on Wednesday of this week, and so the next step in this process is going to the Senate floor for vote.
Well, to recap, the House of Representatives paved the way for nurse practitioners to practice independently of doctors, approving this bill last week to keep in place the executive order that Governor Edwards issued in the pandemic. The bill was 60-41. Now it goes before the full Senate after clearing a committee in the upper chamber. Under current law, nurse practitioners must have what's called a collaborative agreement with a physician. How does this work, Kathy?
So, yes, we have to have a collaborative practice agreement, which is essentially a contract that requires that the physician be available to us by phone should we have a question or need something from the physician. The majority of nurse practitioners we collaborate. We collaborate with neurologists. We collaborate with cardiologists. We collaborate with whoever the patient needs. And there's not a mandatory contract that requires us to do that. It's inherent to what we do. The contract barrier that we find is that if for any reason the physician is not available by phone, then we cannot continue to see patients. And so there are a lot of nurse practitioners that own their own clinics. The physician population is aging, and it's becoming harder to find those collaborative practice physicians. And that creates an access to care barrier for the patients in those communities.
And the cost of doing this is substantial, isn't it?
Sometimes it can be. Some collaborators don't charge at all. But that's not the major issue. The major issue for us is just the inability to continue to see patients if the collaborator is not available by phone for some reason. So that's the main issue for us, is making sure that Louisiana gets the access to care that we need. And access to care, the Healthy People 2020 defined that as, first of all, having insurance coverage to be able to get to healthcare services, because if people don't have any type of insurance at all, they're more likely to wait until their condition is quite critical and then go to the emergency room. But it also means having access to available services that are convenient to you, in your community with qualified health care providers. And so that's the access to care issue that Louisiana is facing. More than 95% of Louisiana is considered a health professional shortage area, meaning that there are not enough primary care providers in those communities to take care of the populations within those communities. And, you know, that's why Louisiana ranks 50th in health outcomes, which was a problem when COVID got here, because you've heard all about health disparities and how people with hypertension or diabetes or obesity had worse outcomes when they got COVID. So, and thankfully, the governor did remove the requirement of the collaborative practice agreement through executive order, and that has been removed since March the 31st of 2020.
And you think it's working out okay?
Absolutely. Nurse practitioners have been able to move to areas that needed more access to care during this critical time that we've been through over the last year. And like I said, though, Louisiana is 50th in health outcomes. So we've really been in a critical state even before COVID got here. We have the worst health outcomes in the United States. This has been done in other states across the United States. 23 other states, the District of Columbia, and the VA Medical Center have removed this contract to improve access to care. 8 of the 10 healthiest states in the United States have improved access to care for their citizens by removing this contract.
Kathy Baldridge is with us for a few more minutes, nurse practitioner in the Alexandria area and president of the Louisiana Association of Nurse Practitioners. How many are there in our state?
There's over 6,000 nurse practitioners in the state of Louisiana.
And for those of us who occasionally have gone to one of these doc-in-the-boxes, quite often we get a nurse practitioner, and they do good work.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I think so, too. And, you know, we have over 40 years of research that has proven that nurse practitioners do provide quality care and that our outcomes in treating acute and chronic conditions are good outcomes. They're equivalent to physicians in most cases.
Well, in big cities like New Orleans, there are 35 physicians on the average per 10,000 people. And in less populated areas, as few as 5 per 10,000 residents. So we have this dearth of doctors in our state. I gather you're saying that this fills the gap.
This fills the gap, exactly. Only about 12% of the physicians in Louisiana are primary care physicians. We have a lot of specialty-type physicians, cardiologists, dermatologists, urologists, and we need those. We certainly need those. But primary care is certainly an area that we're lacking, and that's the access to care, the point of entry into the healthcare system. And lots of research, again, the Healthy People 2020, have shown that when people have a usual source of primary care, their health outcomes are improved. And that's what we need to target in Louisiana. So we need to modernize our healthcare system here.
Kathy, what's the prognosis in the Senate?
Well, it's a tough job for sure. It's a heavy lift. And of course, politics is politics, right? And so we do hear from some senators sometimes, well, my family physician that I've seen for 20 years asked me not to vote for this, and so I'm not sure I can. And I have a problem with that. Obviously, I want them to respect their physicians, but the problem is access to care. And a lot of the patients that we see are Medicaid patients, and they don't, some of them even walk to their appointments. And that's why it's important to have access to care within their communities. And so I really hope that they recognize this issue for what it is and vote the way that Louisiana needs so that we can improve access to care. I live and serve in the Alexandria area. I work in an indigent care clinic. So a lot of the population that we see are Medicaid, Medicare, or have no insurance whatsoever. And we've seen our Medicaid numbers skyrocket over the last year. People have lost their jobs. And so 40% of Louisiana is on Medicaid. But if you can't find a provider that will accept Medicaid, then there's still an access to care issue. More than 80% of family nurse practitioners accept Medicaid.
All right.
Well, not so true of primary care physicians.
Well, we wish you well. Thanks for joining us today. An important
topic. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Kathy Baldridge, head of the Nurse Practitioners Association in Louisiana. And now we segue to another health topic, and this is a compelling topic and a sensitive one. Anita Diamond is our guest, along with Melissa Burton, and they have collaborated for Period, End of Sentence, A New Chapter in the Fight for Menstrual Justice. The author is Anita, who's an award-winning author of many other books, but she is here with a topic that Melissa is certainly familiar with. She writes the foreword. She's the founder of the PAD Project and won the Oscar in 2019 for her work, the film, Period, End of Sentence. And she was co-producer and executive director of the work. Melissa is on one line, and we're going to begin with Anita. And Anita mentioned you've embraced other topics through the years and have received great plaudits for your work. This one is very personal, isn't it?
Well, yes and no. As a woman who has had a life that includes menstruation, yes, it's personal. But this is actually a work of journalism in a lot of ways, and reporting on what menstruation means in the world today and how it affects people and the shame and stigma that is still attached to it and how far we have to go to achieve menstrual justice.
Well, it's noted that in some states, lip balm and tattoos are tax-free, but in 30 states, including Louisiana, tampons and pads are not. The tampon tax has been done away with in Canada. The U.S. Benefits from taxes on this. In fact, some states, and Louisiana is an average-sized state, an estimated $130 million a year from periods. Most people probably don't realize this.
Well, it's also, I want to just say it's sales tax, and it's a state-by-state tax. So some states in the United States have taken the sales tax off of tampons and pads. And as I understand it, in Louisiana, there's no sales tax on Mardi Gras beads, but there are sales taxes on tampons and pads. So, you know, it makes you think about, you know, where we value and what we don't value and what we honor and what we don't honor.
Well, before we go to the break, Melissa Burton is also with us, the Academy Award-winning producer of Period, End of Sentence, the film. And Melissa, I guess it goes without saying, but tampons are not a luxury.
I don't think they're a luxury. No, they are a necessity. And they're a necessity in the United States. And at least pads are a necessity or a means to manage. A safe, hygienic means to manage one's period is a necessity everywhere in the world.
Well, the book is appropriately titled Period, End of Sentence, A New Chapter in the Fight for Menstrual Justice. And many in the U.S. are forced to make a choice between buying food or menstrual products, and those who are unable to afford tampons and pads, the writers note, are at risk of isolation, infection, missed days of work and school. We'll talk about it. If you'd like to join the conversation, obviously a sensitive one, 877-217-5757. Send us an email if you choose to talk@talklouisiana.org, and we will return with Anita Diamond and Melissa Burton on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana and the home stretch. Katie Ann McDonald producing, your number 877-217-5757. An adult topic, but an important one, and one that many people in our country, women, go through and have to deal with. Men like me have no knowledge or no appreciation probably for what it involves, and there is a cost to dealing with the menstrual cycle, and that prompts the book and the film, Period, End of Sentence, from the writer, fabulous writer Anita Diamond, and the exceptional Oscar-winning film director and producer Melissa Burton. Again, 877-217-5757. Anita, menstrual products are not available in places they should be, in addition to the cost. Why is there this aversion to basically avoid nature?
Good question. You know, it's like when I talk to people about the need to put period products in public bathrooms, like in public schools and in the library and in your town hall, people say, well, why can't people just bring them? And I say, are you carrying toilet paper around with you? And suddenly people, the light goes on. This is not a choice, but in our society, in our culture, men are identified as human beings, and this human function of the body, menstruation, without which none of us would be here, of course, this is about human biology, is considered other and private and icky and doesn't belong in public discourse. And yet it does belong in our bathrooms and on campuses all over the country, including in Louisiana. College students are advocating and agitating to get products put in their bathrooms as well. And that process is actually meeting a lot of success all over the country. So I think this is a generational change, too. I think younger people, younger women and men, are much more aware and much less freaked out by the fact that menstruation happens.
Was mentioned in an average state, and we are an average-sized state, 25th in the nation, an estimated $130 million is derived from taxes on menstrual products, and Louisiana has the highest sales tax in America, so it's probably more than that. And I would imagine even for those who are allies, the loss of the tax revenue is something that they probably would not like to see.
As I mentioned earlier, there is no sales tax on Mardi Gras beads. Perhaps the sales tax on Mardi Gras beads could help make up for it. I think that's that's whoever pays for the toilet paper pays for the period products as well. And I think that's kind of a bit of a red herring. What are you choosing to levy very high sales tax on, and what are you not choosing to levy very high sales tax? In some states, there's no sales tax on fireworks or other products that are a matter of choice as opposed to necessity.
As mentioned, Anita Diamond, the author of this book, Period, End of Sentence, is joined by the producer and director of Period, End of Sentence, the Oscar award-winning movie, Melissa Burton. Melissa, when you decided to go this route on the big screen, did you have any appreciation of how it would be accepted so buoyantly?
Certainly, we had no idea, and it was interesting when you were speaking with us and you were saying this is a subject for adults. The idea for the film actually came from a group of high school students who were maybe just menstruating for their first time, and we had learned about this issue of girls around the world missing school due to the onset of menstruation and not having the supplies to manage their period in a safe, hygienic way. In the United States and around the world, we had a partner community we work with in India, and we wanted to get them a pad-making machine, which would make pads accessible. And we thought if we could just, document this on film, if we could just make a little film about this that we could share with an organization that we partner with called Girls Learn International, why then other high school students might recognize that this is a problem in the world. And so to answer your question, no, we certainly had no idea starting out that this this 26-minute film would receive the worldwide attention and acclaim that it did. But boy, we're very glad, or girl, I should say, we're very glad that it did. So it's certainly been an eye-opening journey.
And unfortunately, even in a sophisticated country, at least we pride ourselves as being such as the United States, there are girls who go through this and not know what's taking place.
Absolutely. I think education and awareness about what's happening with one's body is the first and possibly most important hurdle. If you don't know what's happening to you, then you can be the target of shaming, you can be unsafe, you can try to manage things in an unsafe way. So education has to be primary.
Anita Diamond and Melissa Burton, the award-winning film producer and director, and Anita's book is Period, End of Sentence. 877-217-5757. Kelsey in the Garden District writes, can your guests talk about the role of reusable menstrual products buying one cup, she writes, is cheaper in the long run and better for the environment. Is this a practical thing?
Diva cups, what she's talking about are called Diva cups, and those are wonderful. And yes, they are good for the environment. The problem is for menstruators around the world, including in the United States, Diva cups are expensive. So you may not be able to afford them even at that first time investment. That's one thing. The other thing is that in countries around the world, you need clean water, which is essential to make sure that a Diva cup, can be washed correctly and used again. There are also cultures where a Diva cup is not a culturally sensitive option.
I think 20 states and Canada have gotten rid of the tax on these products. Do you sense this as the wave of the future? Will it eventually be the law of the land?
I certainly hope so. And I think the tax is just one part of this. Education, I think, as Melissa just said, is key, so people know what's happening to their bodies. And not just women and girls know what's happening to their bodies, but men and boys. I mean, we all share the planet together. And as I said, we are all dependent on this physical process. I just want to add to the sustainability question. Cloth pads, rewashable, reusable pads are another option for sustainability. That also requires clean water. All these options require clean water. So it's not just about the pads, really. It's about access to safe bathrooms and clean water and privacy. So, and all of these things are knitted together in what makes what is the thing called menstrual injustice. It's not just about the pads and the tampons.
Well, you note many other factors involving reproductive health in America. Black women, for example, Anita writes, are 2 to 3 times more likely to die of pregnancy-related causes, and black women have the highest mortality rate, 30% of any group in the United States. What do you think about that?
Yeah, well, and gynecological and health is a big issue for women of color all over the country, and black women have a long history of being dismissed. Their pain has been dismissed, their discomfort. Black women suffer from endometriosis and are untreated for it at much higher rates than women. And this is about the systemic racism in our medical system that treats black women as different than white women. And so it's all knitted together in this same issue about knowing one's own body, having respect for one's own body, and being treated equally and as a human being by everybody in society, especially by our medical professionals.
A chapter in the book deals with shame, and Anita writes that menstrual shame keeps women from seeking medical help for pain.
Mm-hmm. It does. It does. If you can't talk to your own mother about it, in many families this is never talked about, even between mothers and daughters, how are you going to go to a doctor and ask? And doctors in the past, medical professionals, haven't asked, what is your menstrual health like? Are you suffering from pain? Tell me about it. When was your first period? What's it like for you? This is only slowly being incorporated into medical practice. It's a primary sign of health, like blood pressure and weight and your heart rate. All of that are essential things that doctors should know about your health. And menstruation, if you're a person who menstruates, that's part of your health. And it's not taken seriously by physicians or nurses. And that is reflected in the population.
A listener asked about the religious component. We have about 45 seconds. And you note the Catholic Church, my church, the rule against the ordination of women was to some extent based on ritual uncleanliness.
Right. But most of the world's major religions have taboos against women who are menstruating. And the fear of a woman is menstruating means that she's sort of off limits at all times. And that's true in Christianity and Judaism. There are some rules in Islam as well. And even Buddhism, which one thinks of as being very hands-off, has cultural traditions where menstruating women are not allowed in temples in some cases. So this is a global issue, Hinduism as well. So this is part of world culture, this distrust of and discussed for this very natural part of human anatomy.
The book is Period, End of Sentence. We're pleased to have had Melissa Burton and Anita Diamond with us. We'll be back Monday. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provide signature support.